Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, streaming online at freakradio.org. We're bringing you updates and coverage of what's happening in Gaza. We just heard a statement from the Physicians for Human Rights Israel documenting and condemning some of the attacks on medical personnel that have taken place. I want to remind you there is a protest coming up this Friday night at 5 o'clock at the town clock, gathering from 5 to 6 to protest this assault on Gaza. And then there's going to be an event happening at the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 7 o'clock that same night. That's this coming Friday night. We're going to show a film called Dispatches, The Killing Zone. We're also going to have Professor Stephen Zunes speaking before the film, Professor of Politics at the University of San Francisco, and a couple of folks after to answer questions. And then Saturday morning, there's a carpool up to San Francisco, leaving here at 9 a.m. and going to the 11 a.m. Civic Center protest in San Francisco. I'm joined on the phone right now by Chris Hedges. He's currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He also spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He's reported from more than 50 countries, worked for the Christian Science Monitor, NPR, Dallas Morning News, and the New York Times, where he spent 15 years. He's also the author of the best-selling book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which draws on his experiences in various conflicts to describe the patterns and behavior of nations and individuals in wartime. He's joining us to talk about this crisis in Gaza. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us. I know you're en route somewhere. Anyway, let's just start off, if I may, by asking you how you've been following this conflict and what your take on the coverage in the United States, how you think the United States media is doing on this.
Well, unfortunately, not a very good job, including my former paper, the New York Times. You know, the way the coverage has been presented is that this is a war between two sides who are, you know, both guilty of violations of international law. Now, it's certainly true that the firing of rockets into Israel is a violation of international law, but the proportionality is so off kilter. The idea that attacking Gaza, attacking an enclave, or, you know, a group of people who have no army, no navy, no artillery, no command and control, no heavy mechanized units, you know, nothing but light arms and a few small mortars and rockets, most of which are homemade, is somehow a war, is, I think, a gross distortion of what is, in fact, taking place on the ground. And it reminds me very much of the situation in Sarajevo. I was the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. I was in Sarajevo during the war. Certainly the Muslim-led government in Sarajevo fired small mortars at Serb positions, and if you looked at Serb television, you would see the results of these attacks, but it didn't. It was dwarfed by the 90-millimeter tank rounds, the 155 howitzers, the Katusha rockets that were unleashed, 2,000 shells a day on Sarajevo. And I think we have a very similar kind of situation in Gaza. You know, Apache helicopters are, in essence, anti-tank, flying anti-tank weapons, you know, F-16s dropping 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs all over the place. And remember, there really is no safe refuge. I mean, there's no place for the people in Gaza to go. 1.5 million people virtually trapped, completely fenced in, literally, by the Israelis, nowhere that's safe. This kind of ordinance in densely populated residential areas is unconscionable. And I think the media coverage has completely failed. You know, they, in the name of balance, they have grossly distorted and perverted the reality of what's happening on the ground in Gaza.
In the New York Times today, there was an article about the shelling at the Gaza school, the UN-run school yesterday, where up to 40 were killed. I didn't see the actual New York Times itself, but I've seen the reprint of it in the San Jose Mercury News, which put it on page 10, which I thought was a little bit strange that this very important story is on page 10. But one of the statements in here in this article is that, and maybe you've seen this article today from the New York Times, that the Israeli army is saying it was responding to mortar shells from the school compound. And they go on to quote what they say were some individuals from Jabalia refugee camp, which seems a little odd to me that people from that camp would be saying any of this stuff. But what they don't do is reveal that this is all claims the Israeli army is making. They report it as though it's something they went in and actually interviewed these witnesses, when in fact what it is it's Israeli army information. And UN official, right. UN officials are not able to determine any of the accuracy of these statements by the Israeli army, and yet they're being reported as fact by the New York Times.
Well, remember, there are no one can get into Gaza. You have a few journalists, you know, most prominently Al Jazeera, who were already inside Gaza, but the foreign press has been locked out, and it's been locked out for a reason. Israel does not want what's happening on the ground, the reality of what is happening on the ground, the tremendous suffering and casualties that are being inflicted by this heavy ordnance reported. Look, these UN schools, all of these coordinates, all of the UN buildings, all the coordinates of the UN buildings in Gaza are given regularly, were given to the Israeli army long in advance. Because of that, and because they are administered by UN officials, they're designated safe areas. So you have Israelis, forces on loudspeakers or dropping leaflets, telling people they have to flee their homes. They flee to places like this school, which was set up as a sanctuary and a refuge. The coordinates have been given to the IDF, or the Israeli Defense Forces, and it's bombed. There's no other word for it but to call it a war crime.
What if there was, as the Israeli army claims, some mortar fire coming from the area there?
Well, there was not, there, you know, was there, wasn't there, it doesn't really matter. If you have 400 civilians, including large numbers of children, sheltered in a school, you don't bomb it. You don't drop a 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bomb in near it or on it. This kind of, again, gets into the weapons at the disposal of Hamas, are basically light arms and very small mortars. What Israel is doing is sort of shooting a flea with a howitzer. It's not excusable. It's just not. And were there mortars coming from near the school or not? I can't say. It's possible that there were, but that doesn't excuse the bombing of the school that was designated as a refuge, and that was clearly marked and delineated, and whose position was given to the Israeli army by the United Nations because it was a sanctuary. I'm sorry, it's like bombing the Red Cross hospitals, which Savimbi did in the war in Angola. It's just wrong. You can't do it.
What is the UN saying about, as to your knowledge, are some of the latest statements out of the UN regarding that incident?
Well, that's basically what the UN is saying. Chris Gunness, the spokesman, has said today that it was a sanctuary, was marked, and the coordinates were given to the Israeli army, and that they have, because people have had to flee their homes, they have turned UN schools and other areas into sanctuaries and safe areas, which, of course, the Israeli army is not honoring. That's what the UN is saying.
And I believe they're also calling for an independent investigation to determine whether or not some of the claims of the Israeli army were true. And is that...
Israelis are, I've dealt with this for many years. They're very good at the art of black propaganda, as is the American military. And they will create versions that will get into the press, and then you will find out upon investigation when you finally get in there that it doesn't... match the reality. The problem is that by then it's over and nobody cares.
Exactly.
That's why reporters are not on the ground, because they don't want, they don't want independent reporting. They don't want people, foreign correspondents to go in there and report on what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza at this moment.
I'm speaking with Chris Hedges. Again, he spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He's reported for more than 50 countries. He's a veteran war correspondent. He's written the book War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning as well. Chris, what do you think is the best course of action for individuals in this country who are disappointed with the media coverage, who are frustrated by what's happening and very outraged by the images they see coming out of Gaza, the children, the women, and the other civilians that are just being traumatized and torn to shreds, literally in many cases? What do you think the best course of action for people to take is?
Well, I'm speaking in New York at a protest next Tuesday with Cynthia McKinney and a few others. I think we have to do everything we can to make our voices heard and our bodies seen. It is just absolutely appalling what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza, and it was appalling even before this assault began. With the siege that had been set up, cutting off food and medical supplies, refusing to issue travel permits, which meant people who needed kidney dialysis or cancer treatment couldn't leave. Some of them actually died at the Israeli checkpoints because they were not being passed through. I mean, it's just macabre. Richard Falk, the rapporteur for the UN for human rights in the occupied territories, has, citing Article 33 in the Fourth Geneva Convention, condemned, and this was before the attack, what Israel was doing in Gaza as a crime against humanity, and he's asked the International Criminal Court to investigate the Israeli leadership for possible war crimes. This is, Falk is a former professor of international law at Princeton University, a man with great gravitas and great integrity, and of course he paid for speaking the truth. When he arrived in Israel on December 14th, he was detained for 20 hours, not allowed into the country by the Israeli authorities, and then deported.
Chris, I'm going to let you go in just a sec, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to wrap up if there's any comments you wanted to make but we didn't touch on, or any kind of just final statements you want to make before we
end. The final thing I would say is that Hamas can't lose this conflict in the same way that Hezbollah couldn't lose the conflict when Israel carried out the saturation bombing in Lebanon and Beirut 2 years ago. Even if they kill every single Hamas fighter, which they can't do, the exposure, the gross disparity in terms of the use of force, the exposure of the complicity of the secular Arab regimes, especially the Mubarak regime in Egypt, the anger on the Arab street, and the fact that Hamas, however outgunned, had the courage to resist, is going to empower Islamic groups, not only within the Palestinian community, but throughout the Middle East itself. And whatever short-term gains Israel makes through this attack and assault on Gaza, the long-term consequences are not in Israel's security interest. It is not just a matter of this being a violation of international law. It is not just a matter of an action that I think is clearly immoral. But it's not in Israel's security interest to empower Islamic movements throughout the region, and that is precisely what they are doing.
Chris, I'm sorry, what you said just made me think of one more question real quick. So what is the alternative if Israel isn't to do this military option?
Well, the alternative is, in the short term, to renegotiate the ceasefire that was negotiated by Egyptian security officials as intermediaries between the Israelis and Hamas in July, which held in place until it was violated by Israel on November 4th. In a clear provocation, we now know from the Israeli press, an attempt to launch this campaign, which has been planned for months, that's number one. And number two, to recognize that Hamas, after it took power, lost tremendous support among Palestinians because of its draconian and ruthless tactics, including numerous executions of Fatah or PLO leaders. By carrying out a campaign like this, you play into the hands of radicals. We've seen it in Iraq. We've seen it in Afghanistan. We saw it in Lebanon. The only thing the Israeli assault did 2 years ago was empower Hezbollah. And Israel has to realize that it must speak to the Arabs, to the Palestinians, to its neighbors in a language other than force if it wants to secure its long-term viability and survival in the region.
Can I ask you just one more question, Chris?
Sure.
Just one more? Okay. So the response immediately comes to mind. Well, if we renegotiate another ceasefire, they're just going to use that time to build up more of an arsenal and start firing more rockets. So we need to keep up the heat to keep them, on the defensive so they can't rebuild their forces. What would you say to that?
Yeah, but they weren't firing rockets during the ceasefire. The truce worked. And So in the short term, you want the truce. In the long term, if you want to break the back of radical movements like Hamas and Hezbollah and other Islamist or jihadist groups, you have to give people who live under the boot of repression hope, you know, the possibility of hope not only for themselves but for their families and their children. And as long as you tighten the screws, which Israel has been doing ever since the first Gulf War, you act as a kind of funnel or recruiting mechanism for the very groups you're trying to defeat.
They mean
when you treat people like animals and essentially thrust them into a walled prison where half of them are dependent on foreign aid just to eat, you are going to breed radical movements. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out.
They may not have fired rockets during the ceasefire, but Israel claims that they refused to renew it.
Well, the renewal date was December 16th, and they didn't renew it because Israel made a huge incursion in Rafah on November 4th and killed between 6 and 10 Palestinians and carried out airstrikes. Israel didn't want it renewed. Israel worked quite hard to make sure that it was broken. I mean, Israel broke it on November 4th.
Seriously, this is going to be the last question, Chris. I was just, when you said that about the incursion, it reminded me of something I just saw on YouTube last night, and I know it happened months ago. It happened in March of 08, but when they killed the Reuters cameraman, they shot a clearly marked TV van killing this guy and a bunch of bystanders. And so can you comment on what it's like for journalists, especially Palestinians? I mean, I know you're not a Palestinian, but you must have some knowledge of this. What it's like to work?
I've been in crowds where they didn't shoot at me because I was a print reporter, but I've been in crowds where Israeli soldiers with very clear, with a very clear line of sight, lowered their weapons and fired rubber bullets into the legs of foreign camera crews. I saw it. I had a very good friend of mine, a photographer for Reuters, Manusher, who was very badly wounded by Israelis, and they knew damn well who he was, and that's been a long and dirty reality of covering the occupied territories, which any foreign correspondent who spends a lot of time in the ground in the Gaza and the West Bank will tell you.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Chris, and
not at all.
Turn to you again. Take care.
Anytime. Thanks. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Again, we were speaking with Chris Hedges on the phone just now live regarding the situation in Gaza. He is currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and a lecturer. He's also has spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He has reported from over 50 countries and wrote the book War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He's written some other books as well. Chris Hedges joining us to discuss the situation in Gaza. Before I turn to the music, just want to remind you there is a protest coming up this Friday night, January 9th. 5 o'clock at the town clock, 5 to 6 o'clock at the town clock, there's going to be a protest against the war on Gaza. And then there's going to be an event at the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 7 o'clock that same evening. We're going to be showing a film called The Killing Zone, Dispatches from the Killing Zone. We're also going to have Professor Stephen Zunes there to discuss the issue. He's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and an expert on Middle East issues. And myself and Sami Abed, a Palestinian-American local paramedic who's traveled many times to the Middle East with Interfaith Peace Builders, is going to be speaking after the film during a question and answer.